What could possibly be interesting about the politics behind scholarly research publishing? The answer to this question and more on this week's Radio Berkman. If you've spent any time in the ivory tower, you may have heard the phrase, publish or perish. If you're a professor or a researcher, the meaning of that phrase is all too familiar, and you probably spend a hefty chunk of your time researching, writing, and most importantly, getting your work published. Do this regularly enough, and you might get a parking space, a fancy office, university gym membership, and, oh yeah, tenure. But where does your research go once it's published in that journal? Your earth-shattering analysis of Don Quixote's taboo relationship with Sancho Panza. Your innovative recipe for rocket fuel made from household dryer lint. Your study of the surprising linkages between paper cuts and mad cow disease. All of that research that you poured years into is, let's face it, most likely destined for a journal that will gather dust on library shelves. And that's if you're lucky. According to one group, the tendency of research to languish underused, undercited, and out of reach can actually have a chilling effect, and not just on a professor's ego. The website of the Scholarly Publishing and Academic Resources Coalition, or SPARC, reports that the costs and restrictions of traditional journal access have stifled the flow of communication between researchers, library collections, and the scholarly community at large. SPARC and their allies promote an alternative to the high expense and limited reach of the traditional research and publishing treadmill, which they call open access. Under open access, a scholar's work is published free of copyright and free of charge online. Supporters say that removing these barriers will, quote, accelerate research, enrich education, and share the learning of the rich with the poor and the poor with the rich. But this model faces stiff opposition, and we might just be at a turning point. Peter Suber, a senior researcher with SPARC and research professor at Earlham College, recently spoke to an overflow crowd at Harvard University about open access. David Weinberger caught up with him after to get some thoughts on the battle that lies ahead for proponents of open access, and the promising future that might lie just beyond that.
So I have a really broad opening question for you, which is, where are we with open access these days?
I try to keep track of progress on several fronts. How many open access journals do we have? How many open access repositories do we have? How many policies do we have to fill open access repositories? Those are the main ones. And on all three fronts, there's an upward trajectory. We're making progress on all of them. The rate of growth for open access journals was roughly twice last year what it was the year before. For open access repositories, we now have more than 1,000 worldwide, and the number of policies is growing. When I gave numbers in my talk today, I said there were roughly 30 for universities, roughly 30 for funding agencies, but those are the mandates. Those are the strongest kinds of policies. If we count weaker policies that encourage without requiring open access, the numbers are much larger. And I happen to know, because I'm consulting with them, that many universities are adopting policies now. They're deliberating. Whatever their motive, the wheels are turning at many other schools. But where we are is making progress on all these fronts at the same time.
Is having 1,000 open access archives actually a good thing?
Yes. A common misunderstanding about open access repositories is that to find something in one of them, you have to surf over to it and conduct a separate search. But you don't. All these are interoperable, so you can search them all from one search box. In fact, I think publishers agreed to allow deposit in repositories in the early years because they misunderstood this. And they thought that putting something in a repository was hiding it in a silo where nobody could find it unless they ran a separate search. They didn't understand or they underappreciated the interoperability of these repositories. But they're fully interoperable, and even before Google came along, you could search across repository. But now, in addition to that, we also have Google indexing. Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, all the mainstream non-academic search engines are crawling the repositories. All the non-academic search engines have an interest in crawling them because they're crawlable, they're open access, and because they make their indices more useful. And if they're more useful, you get more traffic, you can charge more for advertising.
So viewing this, for the moment, purely as a political struggle,
yeah.
Who do you see as the actors on the side of open access who are most important in this? And are they all fully engaged in this?
The actors are publishing researchers, librarians, university administrators, some learned societies, but not all. Some publishers, but not all. funding agencies and governments.
How about commercial entities like Google?
Good. I would like to interest Google in promoting open access, and I've had limited success. I think it's in Google's interest to promote open access. And before the economic downturn, I thought they had the money to do it as well, but they didn't want to spend their money that way. Open access could get a huge boost by a wealthy entity like Google, but so far Google isn't spending its money quite that way. It supports open access by harvesting or by indexing it once it exists, but it's not spending money to help it exist, except by digitizing books and, with certain limits, digitizing the back issues of journals.
So one of the largest players in this, universities, you've said are slow. Mm-hmm. Why?
One reason is I think they have a conflict of interest. They have university presses, so the university presses are under an obligation to break even, and that means they have to charge for access to some of their works. And universities are more democratic, and you can't adopt a major policy without wide consultation, even if you do it by vote and there's an outvoted minority. I come from a school where there's no voting, and we always work by consensus, but that's even slower. And so universities are slow by virtue of their form of decision making. I also think that faculty, despite their left-leaning politics, are very conservative in their scholarly communication. They want to maintain standards. They're very slow to change standards for, let's say, new PhD students. They jealously guard the standards that were enforced in their day. They jealously protect the standards of the journals in which they like to publish, in which they prefer to publish. And their institution has given them incentives to publish in the most prestigious journals possible in their field. And they benefit when they do. And once they do and receive those benefits, they don't want to see that diluted. So they're very conservative in seeing the scholarly landscape change. On the other hand, they're about as quick as anybody to see the advantages of the internet and to see the advantages of open access once they're pointed out. What we're facing is a very common misunderstanding about whether open access requires the bypassing of peer review, whether it requires the lowering of standards. None of those things is true, but they were common false assumptions in the early days.
And is there movement towards providing more peer review at lower costs so that, because one of the arguments, of course, by the publishers is that they provide peer review and it's very expensive.
Yeah.
It's an expensive process, and so they need to. What are the alternatives?
Well, first of all, peer review itself doesn't have to be expensive, but it's true that it does have expenses. Just because the referees don't get paid doesn't mean there aren't expenses. The expenses come in the journal trying to facilitate peer review, handling the paperwork, spending someone's time to identify proper reviewers, worthy reviewers, nagging the dawdlers. All of that is expensive. The best survey of the literature suggests that those administrative costs, so there's clerical costs, come to about $400 per published paper. And that means for every accepted paper, you have already paid for the peer review of an equal number of rejected papers. So the cost of peer review goes up at journals with a high rejection rate. It's set to do more peer review per accepted paper. But if you take the average acceptance rate, it comes to about $400 per paper. Now that cost, first of all, is not astronomical. And it could be met many other ways. But it's also coming down. And it's coming down because most of these tasks that require money are clerical. The professional judgment that goes into peer review is all donated. The referees donate their labor, the authors donate their labor, and most editors donate their labor. So the only expense is clerical. And clerical jobs can be automated, at least to some extent. And there is not only journal management software to automate them, but there is a growing number of open source packages for automating this. And the leading one for open access journals is called Open Journal Systems. And it's spreading quickly. And it doesn't reduce the cost of facilitating peer review to zero, but it reduced it a lot. And this estimate of $400 per accepted paper was before the spread of these journal packages, especially the open source journal packages. So I think the estimate today would have to be even lower. But it's still an expense, and it still has to be met. And there are just a lot of other ways to do it.
Since maintaining quality standards through peer review is one of the objections that academics and scholars apparently have had to open access, in addition to bringing down the cost of peer review, do you think that the development of other sorts of reputation systems might fill in, might take care of some of those objections, or we always have a peer review system?
Well, here's where we come up against the conservatism of the Academy. Even if some of these reputation systems worked well to help people filter out what was worth reading from what wasn't, they wouldn't satisfy those who thought it was a loss from the old days. And we'll always have these people with us, at least for another couple of generations. But there are journals that are experimenting with those anyway. They tend to be called open review. Open review tends to be retroactive. First you put the paper online, then you review it. Then you invite people to comment on it. And those comments can be random. Anybody who chooses to log in and make a comment can do it. You can try to limit them to peers, people who might really know something about the topic. But so far, most of the attempts at open review have not been very successful. But what's hard is to get people to spend the time to give detailed, worthy, careful comments of the kind that peer review referees typically do give. I think that problem can be solved. Don't just open it for comments and wait. Open it for comments and then solicit reviews the way you solicit reviews now. Right now we solicit prospective peer review judgments. Before we publish this article, we'd like your views, we'd like your opinion. Well, why can't we just do that after the fact? We've already posted this preprint, but we want your judgment, and we want it the way we used to get it in the old days of prospective peer review. And the difference between a preprint that has no approval and a postprint that has approval will be verifiable on the screen.
And it's just metadata.
Just metadata, right, exactly. So you just change the metadata once it's been approved, and then you put it back online. So what I'd like to see is somebody try one of these open review systems with solicited reviews the way we used to have them. And one advantage, by the way, of retroactive review for open access is that there's no delay in the circulation of ideas. The piece is out there from the beginning, and it's out there in an open access form. It's just out there in an unapproved preprint. I'd like to see it done two ways. You have a human-readable statement that says, this is an unrefereed preprint, and by the way, we welcome your comments. But then the metadata, which is machine-readable, also lets search engines know about it. And more search engines allow you to filter on peer-reviewed literature, and it could tell the difference.
When looking at the political landscape for this, I would like to ask you to focus on one particular iceberg sticking up, which is the Conyers bill.
Yes.
And in particular, if you could explain what's going on there, and in particular, how it looks to Conyers himself, a sort of a sympathetic view of it.
Yeah.
As well as the open access view.
Well, that's hard. On the one hand, Conyers has been vetting bills with copyright implications for a long time, and he's the chair of a powerful committee that does so. And I think he's one of those legislators who is inclined to protect the copyright industry in general because he thinks they're on the right side and that the internet endangers their existence. And so he wants to support them.
If I do work that's funded by NIH and I want to publish, I also need to as an author, permit my work to be published in an open access way.
When you publish, you can't just sign a blanket copyright transfer agreement anymore. You have to sign a modified one that retains a right for yourself so that you can give a license to NIH.
Okay. And the Conyers bill
would prohibit exactly that practice. It would say to funding agencies, you cannot make rights retention a condition on your grants.
And this would go beyond NIH.
It would go way beyond NIH. It would go across all federal agencies.
And the NIH policy has been taken by open access advocates as a highly enlightened policy that you're hoping to spread.
It's enlightened, and it's exemplary because it applies to such a large agency. It's the world's largest agency funding non-classified research. By far. It's not even, the second closest is only one-fifth its size.
The simple-minded explanation that I've heard for the NIH policy is taxpayers paid for it, so
yes,
it ought to be available to taxpayers and everyone else.
Exactly. That's a good argument.
So what's Conyers thinking? It seems so obvious. Why would he be so intent? He's filed this bill twice.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Why is he so intent from his point of view on doing this?
I think his interest is to protect a content industry. He's predisposed to do it from his past experience in Congress, and to do it because that content industry feels threatened by a novel copyright practice, not one that infringes copyright, but suddenly NIH-funded authors are actually retaining a right. And formally, the only way to retain a right was to do it with the publisher's permission. You do it in a negotiation with publishers, and most publishers a while back would refuse, and if more and more of them are accommodating, it's still voluntary on their part. Now it's take it or leave it to the publishers. All that's consistent with copyright, and any committee in Congress that was concerned to protect copyright law would want to protect the NIH policy because NIH-funded authors have a right to do this, and NIH has a right to ask for this as a condition of receiving a large research grant. They don't like that. It's a bad business proposition for them, they think, but I keep pointing out they're accepting the proposition anyway. How bad can it be? So many important voices are weighing in against it and in favor of the NIH policy that it will fail. But I'm still worried about it. I think it's going to cause a lot of trouble. It occupies our time while we fight back against it. And I don't want to underestimate Conyers' ability as a tactician to try to get the bill through one way or another.
So this is, we'll ask you a ridiculous question, but can you get the, we're in what seems to be a long struggle over open access and everything that it touches. What's the time frame for this, for it to be settled, for us to know, well, this is how it works, this is how academic scholarly publishing works? Are we looking at years, decades, generations, millennia?
Well, there's no single finishing line, and we can say it's maybe 5 or 10 years away. There's a series of intermediate ones. Every year or two, we'll be crossing another important one of these intermediate finish lines, another important milestone in the progress, another change in the default, which makes open access not only more of the new normal, but it'll create a critical mass which will encourage more open access in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can find out more about open access by visiting the Scholarly Publishing and Academic Resources Coalition's website at www.arl.org/spark. That's SPARC. Check out our blog for more ways to get involved. In fact, here's another good reason to visit the Radio Berkman blog this week. We're trying something new, posting the transcript of the intro and outro to this show. We'd like to do a transcript of the whole program, but we simply don't have the resources. Do you know anyone who might like to transcribe our episodes? Would you like us to give a test drive to that speech recognition software you've been tinkering with? Leave us a comment at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman, and we'll be much obliged. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find more programs like this and subscribe to our podcast at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.